You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to another episode of MMT. How are you this week, Anne?
I'm very well, Kevin, and hello to our lovely listener. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Anne, we do our episodes live in the studio. Mm. Other times we have to record from afar. Me being in this particular case, I'm somewhere else.
You're far flung, so you hopped in your van and went to warmer climates.
I did. I hung around Melbourne as long as I could at the beginning of the year, which wasn't too bad this year. The plan was to get out of Melbourne when winter hits. Generally after Anzac Day is the time to go. My brother informs me Anzac Day is the last day that you can have good weather down south. He's a Queenslander, mm-hmm. So he's very biased. And I was going to head to Taree, and then it rained in Taree a lot. And the next thing you know, it was July, and I was still in Melbourne. Anyway, I've run away. I'm now further north, but you never know what the weather's going
to
do.
Well, you did say to me one time that being in a mobile home, you can sort of drive around little things like cyclones and bushfires.
Yeah, well, like if you're living in a van, there's a lot of talk about what sort of air conditioner you have. Mm-hmm. My air conditioner is called tyres, which is to say I drive wherever there's nicer temperature. That's where I should be. That's the best air conditioning you can have is just driving somewhere where there's nice weather.
Uh-huh. Most people bring the aircon to themselves, but you go to the aircon.
Yes, correct. Hey, what's on the program for this week, Anne?
This week we're going to be listening to a conversation we had with Mark Diesendorf. He has gotten into what on earth are we going to do about this thing called climate change. And, of course, he's got a lot to say about the use of energy. And that's one of the problems that we're facing. It's the emissions that are creating global warming. But, of course, we're hurtling through all of our planetary boundaries. And Mark has a pretty global way of thinking about these. And what I find really interesting about this discussion, Kevin, is that as MMTers, we are always saying that the limit to government spending is not the government finding the dollars, it is what resources do we have. So we're always saying that the resources are the limit. Well, what do they mean by resources? It's primarily is your labour or your workforce, and it's your environment.
When you have an economic model that tends to push your environment past its limits, you got problems, and it's what's known as the poly crisis. So some people say that we have an ecological or an environmental problem. Yes, we do, but it's one of many problems. It's a symptom of the way that we run our economy, an economy which is unbalanced. The rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, and the way the rich get richer is to ignore the environment in which they live and just keep on exploiting it, driven by the profit motive, and the profit motive blinds them, and it blinds governments, and it blinds policy because that's what they're after, and everything else falls by the wayside. We talk about this in general terms, but Mark, he has a very good analysis of this.
Yeah, he does. And so he's going to help us look at how can we be managing our resources much better than we are now. So let's have a listen to Mark Diesendorf. Well, Well, today I am really excited to have the opportunity to speak with Mark Diesendorf, who is Honorary Associate Professor at the University of New South Wales and a founding director of the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology in Sydney. And Mark is also the co-author of a book that caught the attention of Kevin and myself. And that book is titled The Path to a Sustainable Civilization: Technological, Socioeconomic and Political Change. So Mark, welcome to Radio MMT.
Thank you very much, Anne. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, as you might have guessed, Mark, at Radio MMT, we do look at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory. And that tells us that the Australian federal government can never run out of the dollars. So if we're going to deal with something like global warming, it seems to me that the real questions are what's doable and how are we going to do it? And the question is not where are we going to find the money? So in other words, whatever's logistically doable is financially doable. And that is an approach known in economics as functional finance. And people can go and Google that if they like. So I guess I wanted to start with the big question, which is dealing with global warming doable? And if it is, why does it seem like we're not doing what we need to do?
Dealing with global warming is certainly doable, but it's not an easy pathway. And it requires enormous efforts and a substantial amount of funding as well. The current situation is that we are heading for collapse, both due to climate change, due to other environmental impacts, due to loss of human rights, loss of social justice. The rich are becoming richer. The gap between the rich and the poor is increasing. And the risk of nuclear war is very high. So we have a whole set of crises, polycrises, and we have to deal with them. And the argument in our book and in my more recent publications is that we really need to deal with them all together: climate change, war, human rights, social justice, worker rights.
You know, that really jibes with something that I've heard Fadal Kaboob say, who is an MMT economist. And I noticed you do have a bit of MMT in your book, which is why we were kind of intrigued. Because he does say that you can't decarbonize without decolonizing, that you need to do both simultaneously. So it seems to me that dealing with global warming and dealing with global inequality, these two wicked problems are linked.
Yes, they're very tightly linked. One link is that the richest 10% of people in the whole world are responsible for more than half of global greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a very close link between environmental impact and social justice. Mm. And the problem of global climate change is to a large degree the problem of social injustice, the problem of the very rich. And by bringing them together, we can in fact move towards a solution. And also, I mean, most Australians are in the top 20% of rich people in the world.
I hear that. On the one hand, I'm thinking, oh, fantastic, because the powers that be are going to have to deal with global warming, otherwise they're coming down with the rest of us when civilization collapses. And so if they've got to deal with global warming, then they've also got to deal with inequality. And that means humanity is going to enter this wonderful new era of global well-being. But on the other hand, then I think there's no way that the powers that be are going to voluntarily relinquish their grip on resources and power. And that's probably mostly why we're failing to properly deal with these issues.
Well, that's certainly what I feel, that we have to actually put enormous pressure on both government and big business to change. And at present, we're not doing that. At present, we're in a situation where we have different community organizations, NGOs, working on different problems: climate change, deforestation, poverty, housing, you name it. We have to bring together the different community non-government organizations into alliances for the specific purpose of undermining and weakening the influence of politically powerful vested interests. What I'm really talking about is state capture. Capture of the nation state, the government, the opposition, the public service, the institutions of control and management in society. They are all strongly influenced in most countries of the world, and certainly in Australia, by very powerful vested interests. The media, of course, the fossil fuel industry, the military-industrial complex, especially the US-based military-industrial complex, the forestry industry, the property industry, the financial services industry. We can go through.
You're starting to overwhelm me, Mark.
But they're all related. If you want to focus on climate change, they're all related to fighting climate change as well. For example, the financial services industry, which is mostly a big gambling exercise. I mean, it adds very little to economic productivity. So we have to consider all these vested interests. And one approach by Chou En Lai is to say, well, it's like trying to kill 10 fleas with each of your 10 fingers. It's hopeless, another way. What you really need to do is swat them with one big hand.
Right.
And what I'm suggesting is really the forming of alliances between different community non-government organizations to tackle the tools, the methods used in state capture. And these methods, as the listeners are, I'm sure, are aware, include political donations, election expenditure. They include secret lobbying, consultancies to governments, revolving door jobs, where retiring ministers of both major parties, ministers for resources, have gone into much higher paid jobs in the industry that they were supposed to be managing as ministers, resulting in conflict of interests in the decision makers. And the doors revolve in both directions. So under the previous coalition government, the chief of staff and one of the senior political advisors to the prime minister came directly from the Minerals Council of Australia, which is one of the main fossil fuel lobbies. So that needs to be exposed. And they include the economic system, which gives enormous support to politically powerful vested interests. It makes them more politically powerful. An economic system which, in extreme form of capitalism, is what we call neoliberalism. It's the notion that we should have small government, leave all the major socioeconomic decisions to the market, which means leaving it to the 1% who control the market, that governments should be small, that taxation should be small, expenditure should be small, except for defence. Well, that's neoliberalism, and it is under attack right now, fortunately.
Well, Kev and I are doing our best. That's the flea we've focused on.
Excellent, because it has failed so dismally.
So does this mean we all need to become eco-socialists?
I think it means that we all need to understand more about economics as it really is. And starting as a young scientist, I tried to understand economics initially through the existing conventional neoclassical economics framework. And it never made sense to me. And I was a theoretical physicist, and I thought, I should be able to understand this. I can understand how stars evolve. I can understand cosmology. I can understand how to build a nuclear bomb, but I certainly don't want to do that. But I can't understand conventional economics.
Uh-huh.
And it's only as I got older that I came into contact with some of the critiques of neoclassical economics theory.
Mm.
And I began to see that it's all nonsense.
It wasn't you, it was them.
Yes. And a number of developments, including modern monetary theory, has given me the opportunity to at least begin to understand macroeconomics,
mm.
in the case of MMT, but also looking more critically at microeconomics. In fact, assisted by a professor who's sadly no longer with us, but he wrote a book critiquing some aspects of economics.
Oh, wow. Who was this?
John Blatt, his name okay. was. He was professor of applied mathematics at the University of New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
He was the big brain in the department. Many physicists feel that he should have shared the Nobel Prize for the theory of superconductivity.
Mm.
But he had some insights that kept me interested in trying to find a better way of doing economics. Recently, I was the lead author of a paper written by a number of sustainability scientists and one ecological economist, Stephen Hale. He is one of Australia's experts on MMT, as you would know.
Yes.
And we managed with enormous difficulty to publish in a major international journal, not a conventional economics journal, but a transdisciplinary journal called Global Sustainability. We managed to publish quite an extensive critique of neoclassical economics. For example, I'm pretty sure that our treasurer, Jim Chalmers, understands the principles, but by guess, he feels that he cannot possibly openly discuss it because he would be held down by this huge lobby of conventional economists.
We know that to be the case in politics. We know people in the Greens, in Labor, understand and have a good grasp of the fiscal capacity of the government to spend when it's required, which is something through an MMT lens that is pretty obvious. Governments could always spend when they need to spend. But the onslaught of neoliberalism has been a slow, incremental procedure. It's been sort of done by stealth, where over 30, 40 years, we end up in the situation where it's the entrenched ideology. And your book explains perfectly well how to address the current issues, but the problem is the political will. Is it going to take something of a catastrophe to get change?
I think we're already experiencing a whole series of catastrophes, environmental, social justice, war, and so on. So now is the time to push very hard. But I think it requires enormous pushing from below. I'm reminded of an event during the presidency of President Roosevelt in the United States. And he was lobbied by a group. And in the end, he said to them, "Okay, you've convinced me. Now get out there and make me do it." So what he was very clearly saying is reason alone isn't enough to change the direction in politics. You have to mount a sufficient power from the community to make it safe and worthwhile for a politician to change course. And what we're up against is that politicians are under enormous pressure from the wealth and influence of large corporations and other vested interests. What we have to do is muster sufficient power, collective power, so using power in a different way, from the community, from the grassroots, to force change of our politicians in a so-called democratic system. And it's really important to create that public pressure on politicians, and that's why a film like Finding the Money, the talks that Stephanie Kelton and Stephen Hale and others give, the courses they run, what they're doing is gradually building the public awareness to force change.
I did notice that your book ends with a section called Community Action for Social Change. I highly recommend people get hold of it and just flip to that chapter and look at what issue might grab them and then get to work on it. I still am left wondering how we do that uniting that you're talking about and getting everyone pushing in the same direction. Sometimes I feel like it's just going to be an emergent phenomenon from all the different activities that we're all doing.
Well, there are things starting to happen. For example, in Australia, we have the Australian Democracy Network,
mm-hmm.
where democracy is the common theme for addressing environmental protection, social justice, war, human rights. And the Australian Democracy Network, as some listeners may be aware, was formed initially by the Australian Conservation Foundation, that's environment, the Australian Council for Social Services, social justice, that's two, and the Human Rights Law Centre, that's the three. And it's doing very good work to build awareness using the theme of democracy, because, of course, state capture by vested interests is totally undermining genuine democratic decision making. And let's put this into an international context.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of similar groups doing similar things, sometimes with democracy as the main theme and sometimes with human rights as the main theme that links everything together. So, for example, in Europe, there's the group started by Yanis Varoufakis and others called DiEM25, Democracy in Europe Movement 2025. And they're a political organization, but the focus again is democracy. And they had very strong influencing on an event on economic degrowth, planned degrowth, that was held in the European Parliament. So things are happening there.
Abandon the idea that humans are a separate and superior entity from the more than human world. Give constitutional rights to nature. Restore and preserve biodiversity. Oppose the commodification and objectification of nature. Respect the ecological carrying capacity of regions. Encourage a stable demography. Preserve wilderness. Stop logging old growth forests. Transition to democratic not-for-profit business models such as cooperatives, self-managed workplaces, smaller businesses and commons-based peer production. Relocalize production in order to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Strengthen democracy via participatory democracy, people's assemblies, deliberative forums, participatory budgeting, ban or cap political donations, regulate lobbying, close the revolving door between politics and business, reclaim the commons in the form of local democratic ownership of essential infrastructure, such as banking, energy, education, healthcare, local government, telecommunications, transport, waste and water. Regular citizen audits to decide whether or not to introduce a new technology. Restructuring social media from a private to a common or public good. Repurposing military facilities to produce sustainable and socially useful products. Increase relational goods in the form of friendship, local culture, love and trust.
I'm interested in this whole concept of degrowth, but convincing the public that degrowth is a good idea when we've been fed a model that exists on growth the whole time. So people seem to be comfortable, but also insecure. On the one hand, they've got a nice house, a phone, a car, but they're also financially insecure. So the whole idea of suggesting to a population that they should be motivated by things getting smaller and tackling these problems seems to be something that would be very foreign in most people's minds. So to get a public movement to support this, I don't know how you'd go about that.
Yes, absolutely. What we have to offer people is the human well-being, the genuine human well-being that will be achieved. So what will people get out of planned degrowth is it will bring in universal basic services that give people a basic safety level, whether it's housing, education, health, libraries, parks, childcare, aged care. And of course, that's where MMT comes in to discuss how this can be financed. Of course, this is also where a job guarantee comes in. My strategy, if you like, it's the strategy for transition to a sustainable society, has two main components. One component is called resistance, and that's resistance to state capture, to the power of vested interests. The other part I've called, for want of a better word, visionary, which is to improve well-being of people and the planet at the same time. Not a utopia, but a better world with much better public facilities. And those public facilities used to be much more important in the eyes of government, but the power of big business supported by neoliberal economics, supported in turn, allegedly, by neoclassical economic theory, has succeeded in shrinking them. But it's all nonsense, and it doesn't matter what happens to GDP.
Exactly.
GDP is not a measure of human well-being, and certainly not a measure of planetary well-being. Quite the opposite. And of course, the extremists will call out socialism or even communism, they will call out in the United States. But really, we need to bring those things together into a campaign. But the challenge is getting that message out when the mainstream media are almost totally captured, including our ABC.
When you're talking about the words socialism and communism, as soon as those words are mentioned, they bring along with it this vision of an authoritarian, ruthless, I don't know, almost industrial kind of society. So how do we go about rebranding what you might call socialism? Because what we're talking about is the balance between public property and private property. How do we make that wash with people these days?
Well, I think we can take a two-pronged attack. And one prong is being taken in the United States by Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. If people have been following their magnificent addresses to huge audiences, they are preaching socialism, but they are preaching it in a language of basic human well-being. So that's one prong. And the other prong is changing the language, as you've suggested, Kevin, totally changing the language. And that's fine as well. And I think we need both approaches, but I also think we need the kind of approach that Bernie Sanders is giving to give socialism a better name.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, language is important. I have difficulty in convincing people about MMT if I use the phrase modern monetary theory, because it confuses people. You can see that in very tiny ways our present government is implementing some of the ideas from MMT very cautiously and nervously without using the name MMT, because it is confusing and it can be used against what is really just common sense and logic and basic understanding about how money works and how money can be created and spent and how we can do that without pushing inflation.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev
on 3CR Community Radio.
So it seems like the overarching goal here is a path of degrowth towards a steady state circular economy. And you've mentioned already some of these ideas that mean the end result's going to be more of a well-being economy, and we're getting there via things like universal basic services and a job guarantee. I kind of wouldn't mind delving a bit further into what a decarbonized economy might look like. I was reading also this graphic nonfiction book called World Without End, featuring the work of Jean-Marc Jancovici. And so I've come across a couple of these French scientists who are arriving at different ideas. But some of the factoids that I got from this book was that to stay under 2 degrees of global warming, we'll need to reduce greenhouse emissions by 5% per year globally. And that's the equivalent of a COVID-19 lockdown every year as far as changing our energy use. Also that in Australia, the average person uses the energy equivalent of 700 slaves. So that's supporting everything that we do and consume, how we grow, transport, store, refrigerate our food, how we pipe drinkable water into our homes. And also, they were saying the more densely populated a city is, the less energy it uses on transport, but the more people that are living in cities, the more the total energy each person consumes. In other words, the more CO2 they're emitting. So if we're wanting to tackle these kinds of problems by decarbonizing, I'm wondering, are we going to still have cities, and how much are we going to have to change our diets, and are we going to be constrained about whether we can live where we want? All of those sorts of things I'm trying to envision.
Okay, we've raised lots of questions and they're all important ones.
Mark Diesendorf, founding director of the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology in Sydney.
Let's start with population. We really do need to bring population growth under control. And having said that, it's mainly population of the rich, population of the rich countries, because we are the ones with the biggest environmental impacts. And the poorest countries contribute very little to greenhouse gas emissions. Mm. The second point is that the way you framed it is that it's pretty hopeless.
Mm.
And I think it is hopeless to rely on the transition to renewable energy alone.
Mm.
The energy transition to renewables and energy efficiency is absolutely necessary, but it's not sufficient. We have to undergo, initially among the rich countries, planned degrowth. And that means degrowth in energy consumption.
Mm-hmm.
I've shown in a couple of published papers, including one with Stephen Hale, that if we continue the pre-COVID global growth in energy consumption, there is no way that renewable energy, which is performing far beyond our initial imagination, but there is no way renewable energy is going to overtake growing consumption before 2050.
Mm.
The problem is not renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the growth in consumption.
Right.
And you can think of it like renewable energy is a runner in the 400 meters, coming into the finishing straight, running strongly, doing fantastically, but seeing the officials at the finishing tape running away with the finishing tape. Now, the runner is going to overtake them in the end. There's no doubt about that.
Mm.
Renewable energy will overtake fossil fuels and it can substitute for all fossil fuel use. But if it can't do it quickly, we're going to cross climate tipping points into irreversible climate change.
Mm.
That's the problem. And that's one of my arguments why we have to have planned degrowth to a steady state economy, as well as the energy transition to renewables and basic energy efficiency. And one of the problems we have in the environmental movement is that there are some people who cannot understand that and they say renewable energy can't do it, therefore we should oppose large-scale renewable energy, which is completely stupid in my view. Large-scale and small-scale renewable energy is absolutely essential, but it needs to be supplemented by planned degrowth to a steady-state economy. Now, the urban problem, I have to disagree very strongly. If we spread out people all over the country, even the present population in Australia, out of cities into so-called self-sufficient little communities, the impact on biodiversity would be devastating, absolutely devastating. By far the best way is to concentrate our population in cities, well supplied with public transport, with well insulated buildings, both high rise and medium rise and no rise. And if we do it properly, the greenhouse gas emissions, as well as a whole range of other environmental impacts, will be far less. One of the problems we have is that the existing urban concentration in places like Sydney and I assume Melbourne is being handed over to the property industry, essentially. And it's causing enormous justifiable resistance by local communities. But if it's done right, urban consolidation, combining urban planning and transport planning, is the way to go to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions, together, of course, with very good energy-efficient buildings and appliances.
Reduce goods and services that are resource-intensive and yet contribute little to well-being, such as advertising, arms and SUVs. Discourage luxury consumption via flying quotas, taxes on secondary houses, taxes on sports cars, yachts and private jets. Limit advertisements and ban ads in public spaces. Criminalise planned obsolescence. Introduce durability labels. Guarantee the right to repair. More repair cafes. Make cities smaller and greener, as with the transition town model. Prevent gentrification. Walkable human settlements. Investment in public transport and bike infrastructures. Lower speed limits on roads. Car-free zones. Affordable homes for everyone. Protect the housing sector from commodification and speculation. Rent caps and controls. Occupy vacant buildings. Build more public housing. Retrofit existing dwellings for passive heating and cooling. Build new dwellings that are energy and water independent. Alternative housing arrangements, such as eco-villages, eco-housing and housing cooperatives. Promote common facilities, such as cars, gardens and kitchens. Limit urban sprawl. Control the development of holiday homes. Prohibit developments on agricultural land. Agriculture that sequesters carbon, for example, organic agriculture, biodynamic agriculture, no-till, no-kill cropping systems, planned rotational grazing, permaculture, non-mechanized organic farming. Turn sidewalks, backyards, unused land and roads into gardens and food forests. Protect the seed commons. Eat local seasonal food. I actually wanted to play devil's advocate in this interview a bit because for my own sake, I do want to be reassured that we're being biophysically realistic in what we're talking about here. So on this framing of an energy transition, I was listening to Jean-Baptiste Frisos, who is a senior researcher at the French National Center for Scientific Research. And he's an historian of human energy systems, and he's the author of More and More and More, An All-Consuming History of Energy. And I think the point that he's making is that the idea of an energy transition is the wrong framing. And he would rather talk about decreasing the carbon intensity of the economy. Now, the reason he doesn't like the concept of an energy transition, I think, is because he's saying historically we've only ever had energy additions. So the history of energy has not been one of replacing an old energy source with a new energy source, but the new energy source simply expands the use of the existing energy sources. So what he's saying is that coal did not replace wood back in the 1800s and oil did not save the whales, and that nowadays wind and solar are not replacing fossil fuels, but they're actually adding to the overall amount of energy. So I'm wondering how you respond to that and what you would say to this idea that energy transition is the wrong framing to use.
I don't see any contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
We're just expressing the situation in different ways. I totally agree. In the year 2000, total global energy consumption, of that 80% was fossil fuels. In the year 2019, fossil fuels were still 80% of total global energy consumption, and that's due to the growth in energy consumption.
Mm.
Okay. So I'm focusing on the need for degrowth in energy consumption, and degrowth in energy consumption means degrowth in economic activities. And within that degrowth, some economic activities will actually increase, obviously renewable energy and perhaps the caring work.
Recycling,
you know, that's right. And others will decrease. Like fossil fuel use, private planes, you know, we can go through the lists. So I think we're really saying the same thing, but I'm putting more focus on the problem of growing consumption.
Mm.
The energy transition is necessary, that's the way I frame it,
mm-hmm.
but it's not sufficient. And I think the way you've expressed the French approach is very similar, but they're just wording it in a different way. Until recently, until 2019, renewable energy was adding on to total energy consumption on the planet, but it was actually substituting for fossil fuels. It has been in Australia and a number of European countries. It has been substituting, but at the same time, there's been growth in energy consumption. So in Australia, coal used to supply 85% of our electricity was coming from burning coal. Now it's less than 60%.
Okay.
That's progress. In Denmark, the progress has been much greater. Coal was the baseload energy supply, the prime baseload supply. Now it's gone down to 8%.
Mm.
8%, and it'll all be gone by 2030. And wind, mainly wind, but small amounts of solar and imported hydro from Norway, are the majority in electricity production from Denmark. So there is substitution going on, but it's going on in the context of overall global growth in energy consumption, and that growth has to stop.
Right.
And it has to stop first and foremost in the rich countries, so that the global south does need to develop. It will have to use more energy, but if we can get the global north to participate and spend some money, it can assist the global south to grow their energy using renewables. And on a very small scale, this is happening with a little bit of assistance from the global north at the village level. And if you travel now in the global south, in many areas, you'll see in the villages very small solar panels providing the basic electricity for lighting at night, which means improving education. People can read at night.
Oh, of course.
Small yeah. businesses, instead of kerosene lighting, electric lighting, and the small solar collector will allow mobile phones to be charged will power a small radio. And that's a huge step forward. And you can see that in some of the Pacific Islands, in Bangladesh, in India, in many places now.
You can see this in my van, actually. I'm not a bad example of this. I'm a full-time van lifer. I've got two solar panels on the top and a couple of batteries. I haven't paid an electricity bill in 3 years, which means I've been off grid for 3 years. So I'm fully relating to what you're saying. It works on a small scale quite well.
Although I wouldn't classify you as Global South.
No, I'm not, definitely not Global South.
So this is happening with a small amount of assistance with foreign aid from the rich countries. But of course, US aid is basically being removed now, although it served a propaganda purpose as well as an aid purpose. Mm. It's pretty tragic because it was quite large. So, yes, it is possible. This transition is possible for the Global South as well as for the Global North, but it requires a huge amount of activity. If we do nothing, almost certainly our civilization will collapse.
Mm.
A few rich people, they will have their little castles somewhere, but even they, if they want to stay rich, they need some kind of economy to work so they can make their profits.
Mm.
So doing nothing, I think, leads to disaster. The path to a sustainable civilization is a rocky path. It is a difficult path. So the path isn't entirely clear, but the basic principles are that we need an economy that places environmental protection and social justice equal number one.
Well, you know, I'm throwing these curveballs at you because I think when I take this foray into the area of the resource side, because, of course, in MMT we come back to the idea that the money's not the issue, it's the resources. So what does that really mean? And I think I feel like people who start to look at the economy, you get so many contradictory and different opinions, it's so hard to find your way through. And that's the way it seems to be when people are debating these energy transition pathways. So I'm going to throw you my last curveball at you, Mark.
Okay, I'll try and catch it.
You got your mitts on.
Yes.
Well, I don't know what the reasoning here quite is, but I've heard people say it simply is not possible to electrify everything. So is that an issue? And if so, why?
Well, that's a very vague general statement you're putting to me. When we say electrify everything, there's a few things we don't need to electrify. We want to electrify all hydrocarbon energy, right? That's burning fossil fuels. But carbohydrate energy, which is our own energy, the energy that we use for walking or cycling, we don't need to electrify that, although where I live, it helps to have an electric-assisted bicycle because it's very hilly, very hilly. There are certain things. Passive solar housing is something that doesn't have to be electrified, although I find that in my home, one has to be very active in a passive solar house, opening blinds to let the sun in.
Oh, the irony.
Closing awnings and blinds when you want to keep it out.
You're using your carbohydrate energy to supplement your passive solar house.
That's right. And it's the carbohydrate energy is renewable, provided the sources of the food are not based primarily on fossil fuels, which is to a large degree the current situation. So, look, electrify everything, I would say, is a good slogan, but it's not precise.
Right.
And there are some things that don't need to be electrified. And also some industries, replacing coal for aluminium smelting or steel, replacing coal as a chemical as opposed to as an energy source, replacing it with green hydrogen, is not electrification.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a question of how detailed you want to get. but the basic principle of electrifying almost everything and making that electricity renewable makes sense to me. And we can talk about the exceptions.
Would you say, like, if fossil fuel use was reduced to a small few industries, you know, you hear about this with steel, we need coking steel to make steel. If that was all that was being used and the rest of the world was electrified, surely that would probably sit okay within the overall scheme. Would that be right?
I would agree with the general principle. In those industries, a lot of fossil fuels are used. But let me talk about electricity, that at present we can go fairly easily to 95% renewable electricity. We can't do it instantaneously, but the technological barriers are quite small. Now, what about the remaining 5%? Well, we've done at the University of New South Wales computer simulations of 100% renewable electricity for Australia. And we find that there are occasional, fairly rare events where for 5 days or so, the wind will be low and it'll be overcast and raining. So that for those periods, you need some backup. Now, right now, the simplest backup is a gas turbine, a jet engine, basically. And this is a low-cost solution. Jet engines are mass-produced, right? They're not expensive. And if they're only operated for a few percent of the year, which they would need to be, they will add little, even if they burn fossil fuels like jet fuel or natural gas. But in the long run, there's the possibility of running those gas turbines on biofuels or on green hydrogen or green ammonia. A gas turbine will burn all those fuels. It doesn't have to burn fossil fuels. It's just the green hydrogen and green ammonia are very, very expensive at present. So the possibility is there. And I'm not going to fuss. I'm not going to be a purist and say we have to go to 100%, totally 100% renewable electricity by 2035 or something like that. Well, we might temporarily have to keep a few gas turbines burning fossil gas and hope that further development of green fuels will bring their prices down dramatically.
But if we're using 5% of fossil fuel during a year, we're going to meet our greenhouse targets. You know, there are things which are going to keep on adding to the greenhouse emissions. We're still going to have cows emitting and methane, et cetera. There's going to be rubbish dumps and vegetation rotting, et cetera. So the idea that we can completely rule out all greenhouse gases, it's a question of getting the greenhouse use down to a sustainable level.
Yes. I think actually for electricity generation, it's going to be a lot less than 5%.
Redistribute wealth and income between and within countries. Introduce reparations for ecological debt. Decolonize environmental justice. Decommodify basic human needs. Restore the social security net. Universal provision of services, healthcare, housing, electricity, education, public transport and water. Universal dental care. Increased hospital infrastructure for regional areas. Universal free education and training. Green jobs. Reallocate productivity gains into working less hours. Introduce a job guarantee with living wages. Revalue care and voluntary work. Transform the educational system to have pluralistic perspectives and curricula, such as eco-spirituality and pluralist economics.
If we want to talk about the really long-term future for humans on this planet, right now, I can't see human civilization surviving the rest of this century. I think we do need a truly green circular economy if we are to live on this planet for thousands of years. And a circular economy is easy to talk about, but in reality, and we say this in our book, it would be a leaky circular economy because we don't have the complete means at present for recycling some essential things. Phosphorus is part of our DNA, literally as well as metaphorically. Right now, phosphorus is being dumped on the fields as superphosphate. It ends up in the rivers and in the ocean. At present, we cannot recover that phosphorus, and it is really essential. And there are other elements like that that are extremely difficult to recover. So we're talking in practical terms about a leaky circular economy.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot claim to have solved the problem for eternal life on this planet, at least until our sun becomes a red giant and engulfs us in 4 billion years' time.
Yeah.
But let's start by lasting out the century.
Yep.
And then work out how we can last out another 1,000 years.
Fantastic.
But it's not trivial.
Well, Mark, you know, having spent the last hour with you, I'm starting to see you as the reasonable optimist and really giving me more hope that most of the solutions are within arm's reach and all we have to do is reach out and grab them. So is there anything more you would like to add before we finish up here?
Well, just to say that I'm a mixture of optimism and pessimism. And I think what saves me from pessimism is that I'm a keen bushwalker and I go out into the bush or take my kayak occasionally out onto the lovely waters in national parks around Sydney. And then I don't think about the genocide that's going on in Palestine or the hopelessness of trying to solve climate change within the existing economic system of eternal growth.
If ever you kayak down towards the coast and you see a fellow swimming around in the surf, that might be me doing exactly the same thing, Mark.
Oh, good. Well, that's good to know, Kev.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for coming on to Radio MMT.
Thank you, Anne and Kev, for having me on your program. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Mark. See you later.
Out of this discussion, Kevin, is I now have a renewed enthusiasm for the whole idea of degrowth. You know, we already understand that a decreased use of energy is something that we must do because it doesn't matter if we switch to renewables, we're still going to be doing too many things with our natural resources. So we have to actually decrease our material throughput as well.
Yeah, certainly the way we've been acquiring energy through fossil fuels is a massive problem.
So, you know, speaking of these little coastal towns, I was in one recently and we were driving along to it. And like as you go up the highway, you see all this natural landscape, all the dunes and the vegetation on the dunes. And then you turn a corner and there's the town. And I was thinking to myself, why is it that suddenly this landscape can support 2,000 residents and a whole heap of tourists like me?
Yeah.
I was having a very nice time sitting on a concrete bench with my chai latte. And I thought, how is it that I can be having this lifestyle where just down the road there's just a dune?
Yeah, yeah.
And it can support us all having showers and flushing all our toilets. Why is it that back down the highway there wasn't a town sitting there that can support all that? And I used to think it was about where, you know, you have fresh water and there is a river and everything. But really, it's about energy. Like I suddenly understood that it's about where humans have decided to focus on where they're going to put energy, you know, and so they're transporting all this stuff and the sewage and the water.
So, and so what you're saying is that we lay out the roads, we run the electricity, we run the gas lines,
yep.
And then we can live wherever we want.
How did it become possible to do this? And I think it's all energy. Everywhere I look now, I see frozen energy.
Frozen energy. And I guess the thing which concerns me with that is that people disconnect from the environment because we bring all this stuff in with our energy, et cetera, and we build these boxes around us and shut ourselves off from the outside. You don't know where you are. You could be anywhere.
I could have gotten this coffee in Melbourne in Fitzroy, or I could have gotten it up north in this beautiful coastal town. It was like I was just transplanting this lifestyle to a beach.
should we connect more with where we are? What's
I don't know, but I would certainly feel a lot happier if I knew that I was in a circular economy. If I knew that all these disposable cups or whatever could be 100% recycled, or they were giving it to me only in a reusable cup, or, you know, if I'd gotten there without emitting too much carbon or whatever.
If you could stay comfortable without destroying the planet at the same time.
Mm. I wish it wasn't a trade-off.
Well, I reckon if you're actually more connected with where you were, then you're going to be in tune to the damage that you're causing around you by being there. And again, we always go back to this. There were people living here just a few hundred years ago who were far more in tune with the way that the things operated.
Yeah.
But if you want to see like a good symbol of just how we operate, this rampant consumerism that the economy is built on, it's built on buying stuff, throwing it out, and getting something else, even before it's had any proper use. And the best symbol of that is plastic. Mm. You see single-use plastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now plastic is a huge, huge problem. It's forming small islands out in the oceans. It's a symbol right in front of us of rampant consumerism. And you can see that degrowth doesn't mean...
Doesn't mean decreasing human well-being. That's the main thing to remember.
Yeah, it's about well-being. It's about living comfortably in this planet that we've got.
We're highly likely to increase our well-being, actually, with degrowth.
Correct. So if we use less plastic, then we'd stop swimming with it at the beach and it'd stop clogging our waterways yes. and destroying marine life,
etc. I've heard people say that when the anthropologists in 1,000 years come back and look at us, they will call us the age of plastic, like we had the Bronze Age and the Iron Age.
And the Plastic Age.
We're going to be the Plastic Age.
It's bloody true. We'll all be preserved in plastic. We'll be mummified in plastic in our coffins.
Well, Kevin, we're getting to the end of the hour here. So I hope you don't see too much plastic up there as you're body surfing.
I'm trying to seek out all the remote, secluded beaches that I can find, one where there's little trace of any kind of human existence. They do exist, strangely enough. Out on the New South Wales coast, you can find these secluded beaches with nobody else, find a track out somewhere, go and have a swim. The main problem I've got is making sure I don't drown in a wave. That's about it.
Well, this is the time of year where I'm always jealous about your nomadic lifestyle. I'm very envious.
There's a pros and cons to living in a small square box. And if you stay in Melbourne for too long and it's cold, that's not good.
Alrighty.
Okay, so we've got Vicky's coming in with Mafalda. It was good hearing from Mark. He's a wealth of information.
He's a font of information and ideas, yes.
A font of information and a very nice guy to boot. But we've got to get out of here. See you again in a couple of weeks, Anne.
See you then, Kevin. You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTed.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, I've heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory.
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the permanent income hypothesis, or the Ricardian equivalent, or rational expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.